without any further ado, it is time for History Matters, taking a look back at this week in history with the one and only Scott Washington, historian extraordinaire, joining us here now in the studio.
You know, I could say the same about you too, Aaron. I
think. Oh, and please do.
You are one of those extraordinary historians, and all these listeners are so lucky to have somebody like you with your expertise across so many different fields. You're one of the Renaissance people of Chapel Hill. That makes this a great community.
Thank you.
Okay, and that's it, our
All
show
right,
today.
That's our show. Good night, everybody.
Just like to remind people that, you know, you really got a really somebody who can bat it out of the ballpark every day, which is appropriate because this week, among all the different wonderful things, tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of when Bull Durham, the movie, came out.
Oh, yeah, that's
and,
right.
So they're going to have some special things over at the Durham Bull Park.
The DBAP, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Not but the park made famous by the movie. That one's
right.
A little bit further up the road.
But here's a case of life imitating art, but that the bull in the movie that blows, that was not part of the original ballpark, but people liked it so much
that they added it,
and
oh,
now it's part of the new one. Isn't that a great thing? A little
the Field of Dreams ballpark that they created for the movie, and then everyone wanted to go there, so they're like, well, we might as well just leave it here and charge admission. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how things like this do affect us, and they become part of our kind of mythic storytelling. And in fact, there's a this week in history, this really did happen. So it's a birthday that occurs this week, and let me put my hands on it, and I can tell you better. let's see.
It's going to be the best birthday ever.
It is the best birthday ever, and I can't find it, so maybe I'll just have to go on to something
else. We'll stumble upon it. All right. Well, let's talk about the fact that today is Flag Day.
Flag Day, that's right.
Start with that, June 14th. Yeah.
Which, you know, we think that's something recent, but actually it goes back to Revolutionary War times when the flag was approved, and then it's only in more recent times that it finally was designated an actual holiday. But that's a great thing to realize that flags, those symbols, have importance. And the importance of symbolizing the values that countries stand for. And I think that's a important thing.
Yeah, yeah. So Flag Day is one of those kind of patriotic holidays that really flies under the radar, right? You've got like Independence Day, Memorial Day, Thanksgiving, Veterans Day, like all of these like classic patriotic holidays, recognizing individual people, President's Day, Martin Luther King Day. And these are holidays that are significant and they're celebrated and we get the day off and everything. And then Flag Day, which is just there on June 14th.
That's right.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's important because we have the 50 states, and, of course, states kept adding.
Right.
We have U.S. territories. It's almost like, should we put an asterisk on the flag?
Because we probably should, just as a reminder,
if
anything else.
Right, part of Guam or Puerto Rico or U.S. Virgin Islands, they're actually all U.S. citizens. And so also with the District of Columbia. But they don't have that representation. Now, the latest thing I've heard is there is a proposal.
Is this California?
California.
Yeah,
They're divided
I was about to bring
into
that
three
up.
States.
Yep.
Now, isn't this a wild thing?
Yeah. It's like, you need a new flag for it.
I'm guessing, there's a flag company in Hillsboro. They're probably wondering, how are we going to make a new flag for that?
This is not going to pass, but it's on the ballot, and Californians are going to go and vote for
it. But, you know,
it is
a reminder that, you know, when we look at California, we say, look at that state. But it's almost like, what if there was a similar California on the East Coast stretching all the way from New York to Florida?
Oh, you mean I-95?
One state. Yeah. Basically, one state.
Yeah.
I mean, that, and you think, well, that's impossible. And you can get a little grasp of the kind of challenges that are faced by California and the different areas.
Mm-hmm.
So flags remind us about many different things, including who's participating in all these different states.
And it's interesting to say, and I just kind of flippantly said, it's not going to pass, and I do think that's correct, but it's interesting to sort of reflect on why it's a long shot for something like that to pass, and it's because you could make the argument that, logically, there's how many million people, 39 million or however many people live in California.
Right.
It's a huge, huge state, kind of big, unwieldy, and different parts of the state have very different cultures and kind of political leanings.
Right.
You've got the coastal cities that are kind of far to the left, inland, it's further to the right. Orange County is its own thing. Orange County, California is its own thing. We're our own thing as well in Orange County, but in a much better and nicer way.
That's right.
So you can make it kind of the right. You can make kind of the logical argument that, oh, maybe we should consider it, but people think of themselves as Californians, and it's really difficult to kind of conceive of yourself as being part of something else, just sort of instantaneously.
That's
you can
make
it a case that like North and South Dakota should merge into one, but North Dakotans and South Dakotans won't ever vote for that because they think of themselves as being part of North Dakota or South Dakota, and they have different identities.
So I can say in fairness that that experiment was tried here in the East Coast hundreds of years ago with Carolina.
Yes.
And it became North and South Carolina because that was deemed too unwieldy as it got bigger. So there is some precedent.
But it was also, there's a precedent set, but even that was, there wasn't as much history built up with
yet.
Not quite as much. And then when it was tried again with the state of Franklin, which we've talked about, splitting off
from
into
Tennessee,
another state. Yeah. And then Tennessee did ultimately split off because they did feel a different identity.
That's right. Well, at that one point where North Carolina stretched from the Atlantic to the Mississippi, encompassing what is all today Tennessee, but just the Tennessee side just didn't get a lot of good representation.
But for like a split like that to happen, you have to actually get to a point as an individual where you feel just completely disconnected from other, in this case, Californians.
Right.
And that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, and what would be the name of these other states? I think these are a lot of...
Oh, it's like New California, North California. No, I think it's what it is. I think it's one of them is California, South California, New... It's like everything is some variation of California.
Well, Earthquake California or something like that.
Yes.
Well, there's another thing happening this week, and I think it's... kind of important in its own way. In addition to Flag Day, there's a few things that have been added in addition to the stars and stripes, but like the phrase under God, which you know, we think it's always been part of the Pledge of Allegiance. No, it hasn't. That only came about in 1954 when those words were added. Now it's considered the national motto under or in God we trust, but still that's not something that has been there at all times. Though, interestingly enough, also during this week is when the Supreme Court ruled that back on, June 17th, 1963, that requiring the recitation of the Lord's Prayer or Bible verses in public schools is ruled unconstitutional.
Yeah.
So this is a tension that's always there.
It seems pretty obvious in retrospect, wouldn't you think?
Like
the freedom of free exercise of religion and no establishment
of
religion would seem to preclude a teacher in a public school telling people, okay, now everyone stand up and recite the Lord's Prayer.
That's right.
But
everybody
that was like
says,
a 5-4 decision.
Yeah,
too.
And everybody says, well, of course, that's, or some people say, no, what's the problem with that? The problem is always interpretation and whose view.
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody comes across with a view that you don't like, whether it's liberal or conservative, you say, whoa, wait a minute. You know, we don't want that.
Yep.
Or if that was happening in another country where there was a Sharia law, you would be saying, oh, no, what are you doing having religion
in public
schools?
Right. Yeah.
So there's some real reasons for that. The Miranda decision was June 13th. The U.S. Supreme Court rules that a suspect must be advised before questioning of his right to remain, his or her right to remain silent, and to an attorney.
Another ruling that seems kind of obvious now, and now it's internalized because we hear the Miranda rights reading on every TV show ever.
Boom, boom.
But again, that was a controversial decision, and that was barely 50 years ago when that happened.
It shows that these things really are important, and part of the fabric of our country has always been about fairness. It's about fairness, whether it's extended to people or discrimination or civil rights or something like this, that when someone is arrested, they should be able to, they don't necessarily have to answer questions. They've been read rights and they can get an attorney if they want. And
it's fairness and it's the gap between that ideal of fairness and actually putting it into practice,
which
has been a long time in coming.
And you know, that seems very appropriate because I'm going to give you kind of a sneak peek about next week, which is on June 19th, Regulator Remembrance Day in Hillsboro. This is an annual event that actually I started some years ago in Hillsboro to recognize that date 247 years ago, June 19, 1771, when six early American patriots were executed by, under the orders of English colonial governor William Tryon, for daring to defy English colonial authority as part of the Regulator Rebellion. And it doesn't appear that these guys are much guilty of anything more than freedom of speech, freedom of petition, freedom of assembly. And in response, they were denied due process, the ability to call witnesses, and executed anyways. There was no Bill of Rights to protect them. So something like due process, fairness, that really is important, and it really would have made a difference in these guys. Now, to their credit, they had their own acts of defiance. Two didn't give their names, so and nobody else said who they were. The charges were very, in fact, of the 14 men brought into that after the Battle of Alamance County, two called witnesses. They were allowed to go free, and at that point, Governor Tryon said no more witnesses. So this was going to be a kangaroo court with a predecided outcome.
Right, right.
And that's why 12 were actually charged guilty with this crime of treason against the king. And but there got to be uneasiness among the colonial militia. Six of those sentences are set aside pending the king's favor. But six are executed. In fact, one fellow, and we didn't know this until just the last couple of years, listed as James Pugh, and that's who we think was executed. No, it wasn't. And a historian going through genealogical records realized, wait a minute, the James Pugh that's talked about actually dies in the 19th century. So who died then?
Wow.
Well, it turns out it was his brother Enoch, who went to his grave with everyone convinced it's James Pugh. There's no warrants after he dies because they got the wrong guy.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that something? Incredible act of defiance right up to the end, allowing the people to think it was his brother. And in fact, it was Enoch, which is just an incredible story. And it's really a true story.
Imagine being the historian who's looking at these, at this data, looking at all of these old documents and going, wait a minute, have we been, like, how do you sort of mentally start to question, have we actually been wrong for the last 200 years plus? Or?
Well, you know, one of the great things, Aaron, as you know and I know, is that people go through cemeteries and they note who's all in these cemeteries. Mm-hmm. And that's how part of this was found out. And then that's been corrected. So online, you can actually find this little bit of really fascinating story of history there. And I've talked to last year when we did the Regulator Remembrance event, and it's a great kind of event where people come to this site. It's behind the Orange County Board of Education, a teaching moment in Cameron Park, 200 East King Street. And when you go up to the top, there's this little marker area. And a plaque was put there by the Colonial Dames in 1963 to honor it, and 24/7 it's been educating visitors ever since. Well, when I first got there, it was overgrown, there were ivy, and I had read about some kind of a marble slab. And I thought, oh, it's not here, where did it go? Somebody's taken it, obviously.
Right.
And couldn't find anything. Then as we had a particularly heavy overgrowth of oak leaves, they're clogging up the site. I'm trying to rake some of them out. I hit something hard, and I thought, oh, stone. Let me see if I can get it out. And I kind of reached down, and that 10 inches of dirt and soil and overgrowth lifts up, and underneath is the marble slab. It's in three big pieces, but in about, 6 to 8 inches is exposed. And it's a large thing. It's not where people were buried, but I thought, well, it can't be this big. No. That slab is 2 to 3 feet deep.
Oh.
It's huge. Somebody put it there to make sure we will never forget.
Yeah.
And what we do, and invite the public to come, lay flowers at that site when we read the names, and I think that's exactly what it was intended. And James Hoag, or Hogg as we know him today, who was instrumental in UNC being located where it was, and a good friend of William Hooper, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence in Hillsborough, had a house just 50 yards away. So I have a hunch he may have been instrumental in that being there.
Interesting.
Which is really, really cool history.
That is really cool.
Yeah. Worth coming to. Last year we had somebody show up who was a descendant of Enoch Pugh.
Oh,
who had just moved to the area. And she said, oh, I can't wait. And she was just so delighted.
Did she know, like, the whole backstory and everything?
She had finally learned that. And that made her so interested in this history. Which is a great thing for, you know, tourism in this area. If you want to come to a great place of history, Hillsborough is it.
There you go.
It's like Colonial Lisbon without the distance, the cost, or the travel.
Yes. Or all of the touristy tchotchkes all over the place.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So.
And we were gonna have an amusement park just down the road, but no, they had
to
cancel.
We got close with Boone Village, but
yes,
and people
yeah.
think, you know, when they see that figure there that looks like Paul Bunyan, they think, oh, well, this is just kind of kitschy or something. Actually, James Freeland was a great student of history, and he had done his research. It turns out Daniel Boone really had come to Hillsborough, mm-hmm. which is just one of those great kind of fascinating moments. Like, wait, I feel like the Ginsu Nice salesman when I talk about Hillsborough. But wait, there's more.
We got to have a history written of all of the like amusement parks or theme parks that almost came to our area but didn't quite.
Because right.
there's that one.
Yes.
There was talk about, wasn't there talk about Hillsborough
yes.
being the site of
That's
what
right.
became Colonial Williamsburg?
Exactly.
You got the one in Saxbaugh that was going to
yeah.
happen, and now it's not happening. Like, we keep getting close and not.
I mean, yeah, but sometimes real history.
People
is
down
really
in Carowinds who are just tenting their fingers and laughing maniacally because they're going to keep making bang forever.
Well, we do have Hog Day there, so you know.
That's true. That's true.
But more than that, you can walk on the streets where real history happens.
Yes.
It's in the
yeah.
same location, so
awesome.
That's kind of fun. But
speaking with Scott Washington, we got time for one more.
Oh, gosh.
Did we find the
so
birthday
many.
Yet? Or?
Yeah, Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Oh, okay.
And when
Uncle
she wrote
Tom's Cabin.
Uncle Tom's Cabin, that was the person who, you know, that's a fictional account, but it was so gripping, sold over 1 million copies, and that certainly changed a lot of people's ideas.
Mm.
And certainly we can think of fictional accounts, whether it was Roots, which had some basis of fact, but also embellished as fiction, and other accounts that have moved us so much that we feel like that's part of our history, too. And I think that's the nature of good literature, fiction, and storytelling, is that engages us and makes us involved in such a way that we say, yes, I care, I know, I understand, and that's what good history does too.
Awesome. Very cool. All right. History Matters, as always.
It always does.
As always. Every
and on Tuesday, come at 6 p.m.
Yes.
Regulator Historic.
That's going to be a lot of fun.
It yeah. will be, yeah.
How many people usually come out to that?
Well, we have a good turnout. In fact, a large number of descendants of regulators show up.
Nice.
Which is just fascinating.
Yeah.
And it's not long, but it's, I think, meaningful. And people can bring flowers and lay them at the site. And one of the great, great historic sites of America, and worth visiting any day, but especially on that day.
Tuesday at 6 o'clock at Cameron Park in Hillsborough. Scott
That's
Washington,
it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron.